You are listening to Bonafide Needs, Season 3, Episode 3. Hi, and welcome back to Bonafide Needs. I'm Bill Olver, Managing Editor of the PubK Group. The Department of Justice has released its False Claims Act statistics for fiscal year 2023, including the total amount of financial recoveries and where those dollars came from. Joining me today to discuss the stats and to break down the story behind the numbers are Arnold & Porter partners Tirza Lawler and Christian Sheehan. We'll also check in on developments involving the Supreme Court's decision in Polanski, which raised questions about the constitutionality of the FCA's QI-TAM provisions and how the Department of Justice is using its SCOTUS-confirmed dismissal authority over whistleblower cases. Tirza and Christian, welcome back to the podcast again. Glad to have you here. Let's take a minute again to refresh our audience's memories and introduce you. Tirza, let's start with you.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having us back. Really glad to be here talking all things False Claims Act yet again. So I'm a partner here in the white collar practice at Arnold & Porter, where a significant portion of my practice is defending companies in government investigations and litigation involving the False Claims Act. And I do primarily most of my work for government contractors.
And thanks, Bill. It's great to be back with you. I'm Christian Sheehan, and like Tirza, I'm a partner in the DC office of Arnold & Porter, a white collar partner, and I also focus primarily on False Claims Act defense, in particular on the procurement side. So looking forward to talking to you today.
Well, welcome back. It's always a pleasure. So let's start with some interesting recent developments. The Department of Justice, as it does every year, has released its analysis of the last year's False Claims Act recoveries. What did we see in those? What were the takeaways? Do we see some big dollars this year, some good cases?
Sure. Thanks, Bill. First of all, I'll say that DOJ used to release their stats a lot earlier, like a couple months after the fiscal year ended, and that just keeps getting longer and longer. So I don't know if they're trying to massage the numbers or what it is. But so last year, they brought in almost $2.7 billion under the False Claims Act, which sounds like an awful lot of money. And it is a significant jump from last year. But it's still one of the lower years over the course of the last 15 or so, which is sort of when we've been tracking it. There are always some peaks and valleys if you're looking at, you know, sort of a graph year by year. And the peaks are driven by what we call, you know, quote unquote, blockbuster settlements. And those are things in the past that have been related to the financial crisis, settlements with opioid manufacturers. But so taking into account those peaks and valleys, the average recovery is about $3.5 billion a year. And so DOJ is well below that. DOJ did tout that last year was a record in one respect, which was that there were more recoveries in terms of the number of individual recoveries than ever before. That was driven largely by pandemic-related matters. So you see in the statistics, there's almost half of the settlements were low dollar value matters related to the pandemic. The average recovery was only like $180,000 compared to the rest, where the average was almost $10 million.
And Christian, these are often or mostly Paycheck Protection Program cases, right? Where the allegations are that a borrower falsely certified their eligibility to receive funds under the Paycheck Protection Program or their eligibility to have the loans forgiven. And so these are those cases.
Yeah, no, that's right. And we have seen not much enforcement yet against lenders in the PPP space, but we have, I believe there's at least one resolution. And in recent public statements, DOJ has talked about sort of turning its focus on pandemic fraud to lenders. So it'll be interesting to see whether we start to see more resolutions with lenders. So in terms of where the dollars were coming from last year, the overwhelming majority was still from the healthcare industry, more than 2/3. That's a drop though. Historically, it's north of 80%. There were a few really pretty significant recoveries in the defense space last year, which is driving that number. Aside from the raw numbers in terms of dollars, what I think is the most interesting trend last year is dramatic increase in matters initiated directly by DOJ. So historically, I mean, Bill, the 1986 amendments to the False Claims Act sort of reinvigorated the QI-TAM provisions. And ever since then, we've seen a big spike in QI-TAM cases, while the number of cases initiated by DOJ has declined until recent years when we started to see a bump. And last year was sort of off the charts. 500 cases initiated by DOJ, which is a record by almost, I think, more than 150 matters. Again, in public statements, DOJ has attributed this to their increased use of data analytics, particularly in the healthcare space, to identify outlier healthcare providers. It's unclear how DOJ could use sort of this capability in the procurement space, but they're clearly looking for opportunities to do that if they're out there. And another indicator that DOJ is re still really active is DOJ issued the most CIDs ever last year, more than 1,500 CIDs. I mean, that's only a portion of FCA investigations, right? The FCA investigations there could be IG subpoenas. So when you add those on, we're probably talking about, somewhere close to 2,000 requests, formal requests for information related to False Claims Act investigations. So we'll see what next year holds. I mean, by our count here, and these are not DOJ official stats, disclaimer, these are our tracking, which is based on publicly released information. So far in 2024, DOJ sitting at about $1.4 billion. And that number took a pretty big spike recently with a significant settlement involving an opioid manufacturer.
So Christian, I've heard you say a cynical person would see some correlation between this spike in DOJ-initiated cases and something that we've talked on the podcast about before.
Yeah. So in the summer, in the Polanski, the Supreme Court's decision in Polanski, Justice Thomas expressed concern that the QI-TAM provisions of the False Claims Act are unconstitutional. Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett agreed that that's an issue the Supreme Court should look at. Bill, I know that I think we spoke with you about that a couple months ago. So I would like to think the DOJ shares our view that there's a risk that the QI-TAM provisions will be found unconstitutional. So they're practicing for when they don't have any more relators. Maybe that's not the case, but that's what I like to think.
So on that line of conversation, yes, that was the last time that we had you on, was to talk about the Supreme Court's decision in Polanski, which raised a pretty shocking comment from Justice Clarence Thomas about the constitutionality of the QI-TAM provisions. So is there any update on that? Any movement? I know there have been a couple of cases filed at lower court levels challenging the constitutionality. Just, I mean, they saw that door open and went right through it. So where do we stand on that?
Yeah, that's right. So full disclosure, two of those cases are ours. But by our count, there are five right now. There are two that have been resolved, one publicly, one not. The only public decision that's been issued is in the Wallace case in Alabama, where the court rejected the challenge. And then, interestingly, there was that the defendant then sought to certify it for interlocutory appeal. One of the requirements is that reasonable jurists could disagree. And the district court said the reasonable jurists could not disagree, despite the fact that three Supreme Court justices seemed to disagree. Well, so we'll see. We have one that's pending in South Carolina that has been fully briefed, no hearing set yet. There is a hearing set in a case that's pending in the Middle District of Florida, set for April 22nd. So that may be the next one where we get a decision. I mean, I think the fact that the court set the hearing that quickly shows that maybe the judge is interested in it. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I think ultimately this this issue is going to get before the Supreme Court. I mean, three justices have already signaled that they think it's worthy of the highest court's review, and all you need is four to get a cert grant. And even at argument, Chief Justice Roberts expressed some skepticism, I guess let's just say, about the constitutional issue. So whether a lower court is bold enough to actually go out on that limb and find it unconstitutional, I think ultimately the Supreme Court is going to take up the issue.
Just maybe two follow-up points on that. First, we were really pleased in our case, the one that's in South Carolina, to get the support of the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber filed an amicus brief in support of our client's position that the QI-TAM provisions are unconstitutional. It's pretty rare for the chamber to get involved at the district court level, so we're hoping that carries some weight. I think the chamber also filed probably a similar brief in the Florida case that Christian mentioned that's going to be argued in April. And then the other point I was just going to make is that while these challenges all challenge the QI-TAM provisions of the Federal False Claims Act as out of step with the federal constitution, state False Claims Act statutes very much follow the federal FCA, and there are similar state constitution provisions that basically allow for similar arguments to be made about a lack of constitutionality of the QI-TAM provisions under state False Claims Act statutes. So we know of at least one case in Texas that was filed, and the trial court denied the motion, but it's up on appeal. So it's, you know, in our other case that Christian mentioned, we challenged the QI-TAM provisions in the Texas and Louisiana state False Claims Act statutes. So for our listeners who will, you know, may unfortunately find themselves battling a state FCA, you know, relator brought case, there's maybe some hope there too.
Yeah, and I would just add on the chamber brief. So not to nerd out too much on this, but one of the primary arguments that in favor of the constitutionality of the statute is that QI-TAMs have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, and the chamber does a really, really, really effective job of taking that argument apart and going through the history back from the time of the founding and even before then. So it's a really interesting read for anybody interested in this issue.
One other, sorry, Bill, we keep jumping in with one more thing. We're so interested in this. Another kind of late breaking topic of some relevance here is, in a different context, but very much relevant to whistleblowers, at last week's ABA White Collar Conference out in San Francisco, Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, in a keynote address, announced that DOJ is launching a DOJ-wide whistleblower pilot program. Now, this program it expressly excludes QI-TAM cases. So if your case is a False Claims Act and you want to blow the whistle, you still need to go through the QI-TAM provisions. But it's kind of interesting and timely because, again, putting my cynical hat on, echoing something that Christian said earlier, this new program is basically intended to fill gaps left by other whistleblower incentive programs like the QI-TAM provision, like SEC's whistleblower program. And so one could see a world where in the future, if the QI-TAM provisions were found to be unconstitutional, DOJ would have a backup with this new pilot program that would still be available. So again, we're cynical and, you know, maybe we're just wanting to think that DOJ is concerned, but we think they should be.
Excellent. Excellent. So what else interesting is happening in the FCA world? We're usually not at a loss to find new developments. So what else are you seeing out there?
So we did want to give an update, continuing on the thread, talking about Polanski. So kind of the boring part of Polanski, which I should do in air quotes, was, you know, and the question presented basically related to the scope of the government's authority to intervene in a relator brought suit to dismiss a case basically out from under the relator. And the majority, of course, Thomas dissented, but the majority basically endorsed a very, you know, government-friendly, lenient standard. It's basically the standard under Rule 41 of the Rules of Civil Procedure that DOJ has to make a very, very low showing in order to get a case dismissed over a relator's objection. And we've been trying to track how frequently DOJ is using this kind of maybe juiced up authority power. And we were actually a little surprised to find that we know of at least five motions. These, we call them C2A motions, because that's the part of the statute that gives DOJ this authority. So we know of at least five C2A motions that DOJ has filed since Polanski was decided in June. Five may not sound like a lot, but when you look back to how many DOJ has filed over, well, since, let's say, the Grantston memo came out, laying out the factors for justice to consider when trying to decide whether to file a C2A motion. So if you look back since 2018, there was a little bit of a spike because there were several cases that were filed by a serial relator that DOJ moved to dismiss all of them. But if you kind of leave out those as an outlier, seeing five in 9 months is definitely an uptick. Some of the common themes that we're seeing in terms of the arguments that DOJ is making, one, that allowing these cases to go on would basically pose a significant drain on agency resources. That's an argument that our clients always want to make, trying to get the government to move to dismiss. But in these few cases, we've seen defendants, I think, sorry, I shouldn't say defendants. We've seen the government make pretty compelling cases. And one of them, the case involved allegations about conduct at a U.S. Army installation in Italy. And so the government said, if we allow discovery to go on, we're going to have to, you know, prep overseas witnesses for depositions. And another one, it related to a DOD-wide program. And so there would have had to have been depositions from, you know, folks from a number of different agencies. So that argument, drain on government resources, has been successful. Another one that we saw that's similar to, remember I mentioned earlier, there was a series of cases that the government moved to dismiss because there was a corporate relator that had brought them. There's another case, similarly, one of these five cases was filed by a corporate relator. There was evidence that that relator broke the seal and then kept that information from the government and the court, maybe by lying at deposition. That issue made its way into the government's C2A motion. And then the last one is, in terms of factors that we're seeing, is we see DOJ saying, well, allowing this case to go forward would interfere with government programs. So remember that case I mentioned where it was DOD-wide and, you know, a number of agency officials would have to be deposed. The government said, you know, this is a program that DOD has touted the success of. And so we would have to have a number of people involved in giving discovery basically for nothing. So we'll continue to watch these. You know, again, you can tell from the voice that Christian and I speak with that we think the government should be using this authority more often. But we are glad to see that there's at least a slight uptick.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. It's always good stuff. These are some of my favorite conversations. There's always something going on, and it's high stakes, so it's dramatic too. So these are always fantastic conversations. Christian and Tirza, thank you so much for joining me again today. I hope we'll have you back again real soon, and maybe we'll hear something about those Polanski cases in the next few months. Thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks again to Christian and Tirza for their analysis of those developments in the FCA world. And that's it for this episode of Bonafide Needs. To keep up with government contracting and legal developments every day, subscribe to PubK at pubkgroup.com. For additional expert analysis and insights, you can find multiple timely and informative blogs at arnoldporter.com. Thanks for listening. You can find Bonafide Needs on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, and YouTube. You can help us reach more listeners by liking, subscribing, and leaving a review. For Arnold and Porter and the PubK Group, this is Bill Olver. Until next time. Bonafide Needs is a joint production of and copyright Arnold and Porter, providing legal advice and thought leadership for government contractors, and the PubK Group, publisher of daily news and insights for government contractors and their counsel. This podcast is produced by Bill Olver and Tina Chin.